Hi, I'm John Atack.
I'm Yuval Aor.
And what are we going to talk about again, Yuval?
Well, we're talking about QAnon and the differences between the way regular cults recruit and the way a cult like QAnon or other internet-based cults are forced to recruit because they have different access to different methods.
Can we say that we have some Q-tips about this, or will that not get us to laugh?
Breadcrumbs, yeah.
Q drops.
This is a discussion which is based on a characterization or a model maybe that I have developed about regular way that many cults recruit people and the way people undergo these kind of conversion experiences. And so I think I should summarize that framework, and then we'll see what constraints QAnon has to deal with. So if we consider a generic case of a person, let's say they are going to an ashram in India, and everybody else in the ashram thinks that the guru is God. Okay, now this person, let's say they start out and they're an atheist, and they're the type of atheist that if they would undergo a strong awe experience, which will induce a conversion, for example, if they saw something that they judged to be miraculous, or they had some other type of sufficiently anomalous experience, or something judged to be sufficiently anomalous to induce a strong awe experience.
Something they couldn't explain, something that was inexplicable to them.
If you know, they woke up with a flower they dreamed about, or if they, you know, all sorts of examples. They saw someone walking on the water. But this, our protagonist, in this narrative, normally, if they would have this kind of awe experience, this kind of feeling that now they see that which is really real, without any prompting, if it just happens to them one day, for them, that would prove to them that, let's say, Anglican Christianity is what's really real, right? So normally they're an atheist. They're, you know, they think maybe it's true that Anglican Christianity is true, maybe not. But if they would undergo a strong awe experience, that is what conclusion that they would reach is. Now, this default conclusion for an awe experience is somewhat easily manipulable. So our protagonist, if they would have a strong awe experience, then Anglican Christianity, but now they're in an ashram, and because of the context, because of the social milieu, because of the situation, the expectations, the assumptions, now if that person would undergo a strong awe experience, now it would prove to them that the ashram's leader is God. Okay. Now, up until now, nothing has changed, right? So this is just the potential. This is a person who is still an atheist, but this noetic realization, what they would conclude from an awe experience, has changed. And now what the cult or the ashram people need to do is to induce a strong awe experience. And to induce that, they could... It can be anything that is judged to be sufficiently anomalous. So they could put drugs in that person's food. They could tell them that, we should all meditate for 4 hours and stare at a white wall. And if that person doesn't know that they would undergo hallucinations, then those hallucinations could be judged to be sufficiently anomalous, or, you know, interpreted as being miraculous. And they would prove that the ashram, that the guru is God. Okay, so what we see here is that the awe experience in this story is, you know, maybe through meditation, maybe through, as I said, you know, drugging that person, or through celebrity or maybe the group leader knows things that there's no way that they could have known, or whatever, you know, prediction is interpreted as being miraculous. And as such, cults have many tools that they could use to induce awe experiences. But a group like QAnon, or a group like the one led by Stephen Molyneux, which is
Domain Radio.
Yeah. Those groups are, because the potential recruit didn't show up for a weekend intensive, and you don't control their social milieu, you don't control anything or almost anything. It's many of the tools that regular cults have are not available. So what cults like that, or QAnon, what they can still do is they can still change the default that you will conclude, right? So if you are reading about Q and now you're a believer in Q, but your belief is not there, you're not attached to these beliefs in any way, right? So it's just like a, you know, a trivial fact, I guess Tom Hanks drinks the blood of babies, but, you know, if you tell me it's not true, then I guess it's not true. I mean, I heard it, you know, so if it's just a regular, now we have to remember that people who are in this situation, they're still believers. If you ask them, do you believe QAnon? They'll say yes, but they're not the same believers as someone who is attached to those ideas, someone who would be offended if you would challenge those beliefs, someone who would, it would be very difficult to change their mind, someone who will continue believing even though they would see evidence to the contrary. So we have two believers here, but they're very, very different types of situations going on. So we have our, you know, low fervor, not attached. They just heard those ideas, but they might be in a situation where if they now have a strong awe experience, normally if something like, you know, Anglican Christianity or Islam or Buddhism would be proved by a strong awe experience, now QAnon content or Free Domain Radio content would be proved. And once you get that and you get a large enough number of people, then you can rely on regular awe experiences that people have. And, you know, different people have different frequencies of strong awe experiences. I read recently, you know, I don't trust it, but the study said that twice a week, three times a week, people have strong awe experiences, but it's hard for me to know how that was conducted and how they defined everything.
It has to be highly variable
and variable based on age, right? Teenagers would have more awe experiences, and medical situations general stress and trauma and recent stress, if you know. So if you have large enough numbers, then you can rely on regular awe experiences, which might come from whatever reasons, to prove to you. And now, once this happens, and now I'll rely on an example that I heard on a podcast called Believe Me about cults, recommended podcast. I mean, I was there. So the person who was he used to be in QAnon and he left. So the first thing that he talks about is, first of all, he was disenchanted by regular media, right? Because he saw all the lies that CNN and New York Times and all those with the Iraq War and with the, you know, the Hillary Clinton, Bill, you know, Bernie Sanders campaign. He saw all those things that were, you know, made him mistrust that media, and he started to believe QAnon, but he was still, you know, a little in, a little out, but he was already enough of a believer to take seriously things that they say or to consider them. And so when he heard that QAnon was predicting that Trump will give us a signal that the plan is going, is everything's according to plan. Everything is you know, on the right track. We're about to arrest all those pedophiles, and Trump would signal it to us by saying the words tippy top. And this person says, you know, that later, you know, he was listening to, and then he heard the recording from, you know, earlier that day of Trump using tippy top. And for him, this was, he interpreted it as something which was induced a strong awe experience. So for him, this quote unquote miracle or quote unquote sufficiently anomalous experience of Trump, you know, this, there was QAnon prophesized that Trump will give the signal, and then Trump gave the signal. And it's, of course, tippy top is one of the things that Trump sometimes says, but other people don't, right? Regular people don't. But so, you know, it wasn't that impressive of a prediction.
He might do this. So
yeah.
Or this, you know.
And that would prove, that would show that he is actually, you know, giving a message.
He might use the word oranges instead of the word origins.
So, and you know, why would he do that other than to signal to us that this or that, that we should show up on the once he was enough of a believer, then they could manipulate him and create, with the very few tools that they have, create something that this person would interpret as being, miraculous, not miraculous, but sufficiently anomalous to induce an awe experience, which would prove that QAnon is really real, right? And we see with those kind of groups that the regular awe experiences are very important. And of course, once, if you only have people who frequently have strong awe experiences, then you're going to have a very high fervor community. And so they're all going to catch each other's fervor from emotional contagion and those kind of things.
Mass sociogenic illness.
Yeah, and it's then you have all the regular trappings of cults, right? So they make you pay a price, because you pay, if you start telling your friends and family that you believe in QAnon, you pay a price, because people think of you differently. People might confront you. You might have to defend it, right? So, and then you have cognitive dissonance, and then you have dissonance avoidance. And you have other of the regular psychological tools that are used for manipulation, but the big guns, the strong awe experiences, which are many times so critical to starting a person's path into a cult, with QAnon or with internet based groups or self-radicalization kind of situations, I think that many times they need to rely on regularly occurring general awe experiences that people have, and the large numbers that are exposed to it.
You quickly went over, you use the word noetic, and we perhaps better explain that this, because it is such a fundamental, significant concept, the idea of noesis, which is a feeling of knowing, a sense of certainty of something. Mm-hmm. So somebody will shift into this feeling where they're going, oh gosh, that it must be true, because you know he said oranges, and therefore,
and it's really real. It's not the ordinary truth. It's not, which, and the thing is that things that are really real are surprisingly also easier to ignore, but they're also easier to rely on and hang on all of your life on. So you can be a Christian and not turn the other cheek when you're struck, not hate, not love
pick
your
up a stone enemy. And throw it at somebody in a form of criticism. Yeah, absolutely.
And not give all your money to the poor, because it's very easy to ignore. But there would be Christian sects where they will take all that seriously and will give everything to the poor. Or there's cults that of poverty, right? That so the fact that people see it as really real doesn't mean that they will act on it, but still it can be extremely central to their decision makings and to ways that people might manipulate them.
And it's I mean, sometimes the word transcendence is used and abused in this sense of an experience being more vivid than normal experience.
And the thing is, because of this vividness, because people actually feel like they experienced something that, for example, someone might say, you know, I had a near-death experience and I experienced God, and there's nothing you can say. There's nothing your lips can move to make me not know what I saw with my own eyes.
Now, I know it.
This kind of person, if you tell them that they're wrong, they very likely would see it as gaslighting. Now, gaslighting, by definition, needs to have a manipulative intention on the side of the manipulator. Yeah. But from the side of the person who is being gaslit, they're like, I saw something with my own experience, and now you're telling me that my experience was wrong, which is the way regular gaslighting works, right? Where you tell people, oh, no, well,
the lights
that,
didn't
that never happened. Yeah,
I mean, I had a specific example of this many years ago. A young man told me that he had had a vision of a line of scripture on the wall in front of him. And how could I possibly explain that? Now, his mother was horrified because she was an atheist. And the explanation of, you know, what you might have noticed at any point in the tens of years living up, you know, leading up to that, that you can now project outwards, it's altogether too simple. There was no way that he, you know, he was now going to church every week and that was that. He'd had a revelation, something had appeared there.
Yeah. And for you to tell him, no, you actually didn't see that on the wall, for him, that would look like gaslighting. That doesn't seem like, you know, why are you telling me things that I know are not the way reality is? So it's you need to be careful with that, because
and there's a noticeable response which is there in all believers, all fervent believers. They know they're right, and they therefore know that they're superior in their understanding to you, and so there's a sort of almost parental condescension that then occurs if you try to say anything to them. It's why, you know, the finding out how to talk to somebody who's fanatical, who's fervent. You know, I spent 7 years after leaving Scientology before I could confidently have a conversation with almost anybody about almost anything, which is actually meant to be one of the things you learn how to do early on in Scientology. You learn how to communicate to anyone on any subject. But I came to the point where you do have to be careful that you're not being judgmental and that you're not projecting that thing, well, you're stupid, you know, why would you believe that nonsense? And where you're allowing, I mean, with the street epistemologists, one of the things they do have right is this idea of getting the person to talk about their beliefs, allowing them to talk about their beliefs. And that can sometimes lead to them falling off the cliff. And so we go, actually, that is a stupid thing to believe. But
saying, how would they know what I think if they don't hear what I say?
Exactly. And that's
so when you hear yourself saying it, it's very different than just thinking.
Yeah. I mean, I've so often used the example, but it is my favorite. When I was 17, I spent a couple of hours because I had time to waste back then, listening to a guy who was trying to talk me into Jesus and all of that stuff. And which was great. And we talked scripture and all of that for, you know, my perception. I just reread the Gospels as an agnostic, and I was fascinated by some of the good advice in them. You know, consider the tree by the fruit thereof. That's a very good piece of advice. If the fruit's no good, chop the tree down. That's what I say. But at the end of 2 hours, he became exasperated and backed away from me, I think because he thought I must be diabolic and would leap on him and tear him to shreds or something. And he said, I don't understand the Bible, but I know it's all true. And there's a noetic experience and how.
Well, there's the
I don't know what it means, but I know that what it means is right.
The more extreme version is a quote by a early Christian called Tertullian, which says, it is true because it is impossible. So not only it's impossible, and still it's true. No, it's impossible, and that is why it is inevitable or true. It's, I think it's translated in different ways. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that brings us to somebody, and they've now, I mean, there is something else that is averred about QAnon, which is that when it began on the dark web on 4chan as a gaming activity, that it is put forward that they were actually seeking to insert subliminal messages into video games. And this is a place where, you know, I have some difficulty, because I'm not sure how effective such things are anyway. I think certainly the repetition of such things may well have an effect. And I've seen, you know, there are a couple of studies in neuroscience showing that it appears that during hypnotic episodes, a different part of the brain is active than during normal conversation, for example. I do have difficulty with it, but I think that it shouldn't be written out, that there is a possibility that one can come to believe something simply because it's been repeated often enough, for example, through an advertisement or what have you. This is one of the things that we know about PR.
And when you say belief, again, we need to remember that maybe this only brings them to the regular belief that they're not attached to, that they're like, well, I don't know, I heard that, is that true? But that later can be cemented as what is really real when it goes through a certain type of awe experience or a noetic and knowing experience. Yeah.
Yeah. When you see the line of scripture,
so
you know, the writing on the wall, you know.
A lot of people make the mistake to think that a person is a conspiracy theorist if they believe in conspiracies, but no, it's the type of belief. It's not just believing, because, you know, I can believe that whatever, that, you know, the FBI or the CIA killed JFK, but if I don't care about, you know, if I'm willing to give up that belief, if I'm not offended if someone doesn't believe it, if it does, then people would say, yeah, I'm still a conspiracy theorist. But I think that what actually people mean by conspiracy theorist is the type of believer that not only believes this type of thing, but also would not change their mind, would also not accept contrary evidence, would also be insulted when it's challenged. So that is actually, I think, that what's a lot more important than the whatever it is that the person believes.
I agree. I mean, you use the term fervor, which I think is perfectly good. The passion with which somebody believes something. Mm-hmm. My father advised me as a young man that you never discuss politics or religion with a Frenchman. And he'd just come back from, you know, 3 months of living. He spoke French and he was living and working in France. But he found this thing that there was a passion there that he didn't find among the English, who are a more sedate, embarrassed, and shy people generally.
And where revolution and murdering your king is not a central part of your national ethos.
Well, we did it first. Come on, be fair.
Yeah, you know, but
king murder is, you know, regicide. It's something.
Yeah, but it's not part of the English identity the way it is part of the
French. We invited his son back because we didn't know what to do after that. You know, had a few years of a bloke who had lots of warts, and then his son proved to be useless when they tried to make him king, because that's how democracy works. You know,
but that is actual history. You know, a nation like the French, a nation is a group of people who share a common mistake about their ancestry. So it's not about what actually happened. It's about how they think about it. Yeah.
And the consequence of the revolution was that a man from Corsica, who was actually of normal height, as you have said, was able to become emperor. And there's that moment where Ludwig von Beethoven tears up the dedication to, I think it's the Eroica, because he realizes that rather than bringing democracy and liberty to everyone, he is just installing his own relatives as kings. And yet he remains a great hero of the French. I mean, the advertisement that was common in the UK was Courvoisier, the brandy of Napoleon. And I know that Hitler was a teetotaler, but it always made me think, schnapps, the drink of Hitler. You know, why is this guy lionized? Why is he made in such a hero?
Maybe in a few hundred years, maybe we will have, you know, Hitler's something.
The alcohol-free schnapps of Hitler. Yeah. Cherry brandy.
Yeah, I mean, today people like Genghis Khan or Napoleon, all sorts of, you know, Alexander the Great are remembered fondly.
Mm. And it is a fascinating point of history. And again, it depends where you live. If you live in Turkey, then you tell your children, if you don't go to sleep, Alexander will come and get you. yeah. But if you know, we're in Iran, Mongolia, of course, the Khans are great heroes to this day because they were
victors. In England, Bonnie would come, right? Bonaparte.
Yeah, Boney. Yeah. And you know, it amazes me looking at, you know, a huge picture of Mao Zedong, the greatest mass murderer in all history, 70 million people, that there he is in Tiananmen Square, smiling down benignly upon the people.
And looking at you from the money notes, right?
Yeah, and it takes us into the sort of fantasy that exists in our minds, which is belief, that which is so connected to passion, as you say, that it doesn't matter. If I'm not willing to kill you because you disagree with me, it really doesn't matter as much.
And in that case, with the case of Mao Zedong, it can also just become part of an ideology that you are blind to, that you're not even aware that you are a supporter of Mao, or that you're tolerant of Mao, or that you think you're just seeing it as, you know, that's an obvious that everybody believes that Mao is a good, you know, or you can go your own whole life without reflecting on this aspect of your knowledge that you didn't know was actually part of the way you think, because it just seems so natural.
Yeah, and it's only when it's challenged that there's any thought about it. Mm-hmm. And it can feel, you know, the cognitive dissonance, that irritation and annoyance, simply because it disagrees with something that's a commonplace to you, that's something you've thought. Looking at Adam Curtis's Can't Get You Out of My Head, something I'd never seen before, the National Bolshevik Party, who rose up against Yeltsin. And you have people wearing armbands, you know, the red and white and black of the Nazis, with a hammer and sickle on them. And they're like skinheads, you know. And of course, they're protesting against a dreadful, dreadful situation where, you know,
sickle is a very non-national, actually anti-national symbol too.
Was meant to be. But just the national socialism, there's already a little bit of a problem in that.
Yeah, one. But in that case, the national socialism, that is the Nazis' attempt to steal the symbols of socialists. So like, they would adopt the 1st of May as the Nazi holiday. The red flag, the red color became and it was just so, if you're a communist, you cannot wave a red flag on May 1st. And they're like, oh, that's a Nazi, you know? Oh, you call yourself a socialist? We're national socialists. So it was an early on a way to steal the symbols of communists.
They did do that, but I'm going to disagree, if you'll forgive me.
Sure.
But firstly, that the word socialism was in Germany comes from Bismarck. It doesn't mean communism. It doesn't mean left wing.
Sure.
It means a party that's for the people. And of course, Hitler's platform was a platform of equality. While he himself simpered around the aristocrats,
a certain type of equality within.
Well, look at what he did to the school system, you know, breaking everything down in the attempt to make it equal.
But if you were Jewish,
just the bullies be in charge. Yeah,
but if you're Jewish, you're not equal.
But okay. Socialism is not necessarily, for example, if you look at socialism in the northwest of the US in the 1880s and the Sinophobe movement that actually was fueled by socialists. So racism
Of course.
Is quite possible within this context.
You say equality, you need to, it's not general equality.
Well,
it's a certain type of equality.
You have the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, this idea, all men are created equal, women aren't. and nor are people who aren't white and European. But apart from that, it is you know, the manifest destiny of equality.
Yeah.
And, you know, but some are more equal than others, as George Orwell pointed out, particularly the pigs, as I remember, including Napoleon, who was at that point a pig, not a French emperor. It's all very confusing history.
Yeah. All right. I think we said a few things. Hopefully, the audience found you know, got something from it,
and will hopefully comment upon and question us about, because we do not particularly keen on being insulted, but being quizzed and having something more to talk about.
And also, I mean, I'm not an expert on QAnon specifically, or on the Stefan Molyneux's internet group. So I'm sure there might be people who have either anecdotes or something that you know, contradicts what we said or supports what we said. But
and if they can point us towards other channels or other podcasts where we can go and talk to people about this and become incredibly famous and rich, that would be really wonderful. And there we will give them a commission, you know, of 1%. Okay.
All right.
Always great talking with you, Yuval. Yes. Thanks so much.
I'm
John Atack. This is my guest, Yuval Lowell, PhD.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon. Or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.
Can we say that we have some Q-tips about this, or will that not get us to laugh?